Welcome to the 4 o'clock show, Voices from the Frontline segment on KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. This is Damon Azali. I'm here with my co-host, Eric Mann. Today we have a great show for everybody. Starting the year off with two of my favorite things, pardon the pun, a little bit of jazz and a little bit of politics. So first off, we're going to be talking to Robin D.G. Kelly, who's the author of Freedom Dreams, Your Mama's Dysfunctional, and Hammer and Hall, and a whole bunch of other books that young today's activists and organizers should check out and read. Robin Kelly is a professor of anthropology, African-American studies, and jazz studies at Columbia University, and he will be talking about his forthcoming book about Thelonious Spear Monk. And for our second segment, we'll be chopping up with Xochitl Barrera, who is the co-director of FLIC, Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children. She'll be talking to us about how they helped close two of the five youth authorities in Louisiana and how they're working on their third. So we'll be right back with Robin D.G. Kelly.
And tell them that we're playing this.
So welcome back to the Voices from the Front Lines. We have on the line Robin D.G. Kelly. Robin, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, just ran in the house.
All right. So we already talked a little bit about that. You're actually writing a book about Thelonious Monk.
Yes, I am.
And one question I had for you, based on kind of all the jazz musicians that they are out there, from Coltrane to Ellington to Max Roach to Charles Mingus, why did you decide to write a book on Thelonious Monk?
Well, I guess there are a couple of reasons. One is very personal in that when I was in high school, my goal wasn't to become a historian or even to be an activist. It was to be a pianist and to play like Thelonious Monk. I just loved his music. And, you know, and though I'm kind of a self-taught pianist, his music has always been a real challenge, you know, not just to me, but everyone who claims to play this instrument. His compositions are just remarkable and strange, you know, strange in a great way. He thought about music in ways that are really incomparable, and you can't find anyone who plays piano who sounds like him, really. But the other reason is probably more political. Monk is one of these figures who is, we'll talk about, was never seen as on the front lines. You know, he'd been quoted as saying that he wasn't interested in politics, and yet behind the scenes he was not just knowledgeable, but was always active, playing benefits for various civil rights organizations, making pretty sharp statements against police brutality, and even paying a benefit for Paul Robeson when no one was supporting Robeson. So he struck me as a very interesting character and would make a great book. And I tell you, when I finish this book, I think it will be really interesting. But it's been a long time in the works. You know?
So we have actually a couple of different cuts that we're going to play throughout the interview. So I thought we should start off with one of them. The first one we have laid out is all the things that you are. So why don't you introduce for us and tell us what we should be looking for?
Sure, yeah. But before you do that, let me just say a couple things about the song that you played, Skippy,
right.
Which you opened up the show with, which is a rare Monk tune recorded in 1948. And it was named after his sister-in-law, Evelyn, whose nickname was Skippy. And for those of you who, like, listen real carefully, you notice that the song is based on T for Two. You know, you can sort of hear the melody. The song we're about to hear, All the Things You Are, is one of the few recordings where Monk is playing with a vocalist. And the vocalist is named Kenny Haygood, who had this really smooth voice, kind of a Billy Eckstein style. Mm-hmm. And what you hear Thelonious Monk in the vibe play of Milt Jackson doing behind him is kind of, you know, what's the word? He's almost like he's playing tricks behind him. It's very mischievous. And he takes a beautiful ballad and transforms it into this sort of swinging song with all these funny things going on behind him. So imagine trying to sing like Kenny, Kenny Haygood when you got all this music behind him, and you'll hear what I'm talking about. But this record, I believe, was made in 1948, July. Oh, I'm sorry, Skippy was made in 1952. Okay.
So we're going to hear All the Things You Are by Thelonious Monk, and it runs about 3 minutes, so we're going to play the whole thing.
Okay.
Springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long. You are the breathless hush of evening that lingers on the brink of a lovely song. You are the a star. The dearest things I know are what you are. Someday my happy arms will hold you, and someday I'll know that moment divine.
Welcome back. That was All the Things You Are by Thelonious Monk. On the line, we have Robin D.G. Kelly, who is, now that I found out, is also a pianist, but also is a, he's writing a book about Thelonious Monk. So, Robin, why don't you tell us a little bit about what we just heard?
Sure. I always crack up when I listen to that song. It's one of the funniest songs I've ever heard. What's amazing about it is that this singer, Kenny Haygood, is actually competing with Monk and with Milt Jackson, who were playing all these runs, very dissonant, you know. I mean, Monk was known for dissonance and for what they call rhythmic displacement, where he plays rhythms that are not always on the beat, kind of off the beat. You know, there's so much going on in that song that, to me, makes it one of the premier examples of what was called modern jazz, you know, the kind of bebop era, where, you know, the rhythms are freer, usually up-tempo, the harmonies are much more dissonant, and Monk was really a master of that, you know. I don't think that, I mean, I would love to know what Haygood thought when he had to sing and how he was able to stay in pitch, you know, with all that stuff going on behind him, you know. But so it's a great song, and it was, interestingly enough, it was recorded in 1948 when there was a recording ban. The American Federation of Musicians had established a national ban on recording, and somehow they got into the studio and did it despite the ban, which I thought was always interesting.
And this is also the Kenny Haygood that recorded Darn That Dream on the end of Birth of Cool, Miles Davis album. I think it's like track 10.
Yeah, absolutely. He's got a lovely voice, which is why the combination of Monk's dissonance and Kenny Haygood's voice just makes for an interesting musical experience.
Hey, Robin, it's Eric, man.
Hey, Eric,
how you doing? I'm good. Two things. What's the name of your book? And since all your emails say, leave me alone, I'm doing a book on Monk, what's it like doing a book on Monk?
Well, the title now is simply Thelonious, A Life. You know, it's a big biography. It's much more comprehensive than I planned because it goes back, really goes back to his family roots. You know, I mean, I trace his roots back to 1797, you know, and through his family story, we see this amazing saga of slavery and freedom in North Carolina up until his birth in 1917, October 10th, and then his family moves from Rocky Mount, North Carolina, to New York City in 1922, where he grows up in the San Juan Hill area of New York, which, for those of you who may not be familiar, it's basically the west side of New York City, west side of Manhattan, in the 60s, near where Lincoln Center is now.
Hmm.
And that was a predominantly black, predominantly black community, both Caribbean and African American. And so he grew up around all this different music. What's it like to write this book? This has been like a 9-year project for me, and 2005 is the final year that I guarantee. And it's been interesting because I'm the first scholar to ever have access, you know, to the family, who shared a great deal with me, not just in terms of materials and rare documents, but family stories. One of the great things about Monk's life, at least for me at least, is that it's not just a story of an individual sort of genius, you know, which is, or tragic genius for that matter, which is common in the narratives of jazz musicians. It is a story about a man and his family. It's about his love affair with his wife, his fatherhood. You know, he had two children, all the nieces and nephews who hung out with him. It's about all of his extended family, and they played such a key role in sustaining him, and vice versa. And it's also about his ancient traditions, you know, his ancestors, you know, who really helped shape him as a child growing up. And this is a man whose mother and father came of age when black people were losing the vote in the late 19th century in a county in North Carolina that was known for having more black elected officials than black voters. You know, it was a very violent suppression of the black vote. And his father grew up as a kid among that, you know. And Monk himself was very, very political, I think as a result of his father, of his mother's political activism and her concern, her activities in the Democratic clubs in New York City. So there's a lot to the story.
So I know when I listened to read stories around Charles Mingus, there were a lot of different events in his life that have helped kind of him come out politically. So when we listen to some of the stuff like Fables of Phoebus, et cetera, that are built on these experiences, can you talk about one or two experiences that Thelonious Monk had in his childhood or in his adolescence that was based around some of these experiences of oppression that contributed to his
work? Yeah, well, I think the most important set of experiences has to do with his relationship with the law. Thelonious had been arrested 4 times, actually. The first time in Washington, D.C., when he was fairly young, about 1943, I believe, over a marijuana charge. Then he was arrested again in 48 over a marijuana charge. In 1951, he was arrested on a more serious charge where he was in a car with the famous pianist Bud Powell and two other hustlers sitting in a car in Columbus Circle, and the police rolled up on them in August. And it turned out that Bud Powell had some heroin on him, threw it out the car. Monk was arrested, but he refused to testify against his friends, served 60 days in Rikers Island in the workhouse. And as a result of that, he lost his cabaret card. Mm. The cabaret card is what you need in New York City to play at any venue that serves alcohol, which basically means any jazz club. And it slowed down his work considerably. And the last arrest was in 1960 in Delaware, where he was basically in a car with the Baroness Panonica de Koniswater, who was a very wealthy patron of jazz. And he was driving, and he and Charlie Rouse was in the car, his saxophone player. The police stopped him. He stopped at a hotel to get some water. And this is in Delaware. This is still the Deep South in some respects. He goes and asks for a glass of water, and he drinks it. They call the police because they think that he's some suspicious character. The police come running in there and start beating him up for no other reason than he's standing there with a glass of water. And he ends up going to jail over that, although, you know, they had to drop the charges. But it turned out that the Baroness had some marijuana in the trunk or something like that. And so she ended up having to pay a fine. But all four of those incidents were key for him, because one thing that he always talked about when he talked about his experiences growing up was the police, how the police beat up on black people, you know. And he even said that in the context of an interview where he said he had no interest in politics at all, you know. So I think the police relationship was key. And then the other thing I should mention is it's not so much an event as much as the people around him, the community that created him. I mean, San Juan Hill was a very political community with a lot of significant black intellectuals and black activists living there. He went to community center as a kid where they had classes and volunteers who would teach kids music, elocution, you know, arts and crafts. And his best friend, who happened to be, would later become his brother-in-law, this is his wife Nellie's brother, Sonny, he was very, very political, read every single book he can get his hands on. He was one of these guys who used to go to Michaud's bookstore on 125th Street and buy all the black books and then, you know, give speeches in the house. And Monk absorbed a lot of that. He heard these stories about Africa, about struggles in the United States, about Reconstruction. And I think this is one of the reasons why he so admired Paul Robeson. I mean, when Monk was interviewed, I believe it was 1963, Whitney Balliet, the jazz critic, said, ask him to name the most significant figure in history as far as he's concerned. He mentioned George Washington Carver. But he said, name the most significant athlete, and Monk named Paul Robeson. You know? Now, it's not because he's crazy. He knew exactly what he was doing, you see. So you could see it both in the interview, the few interviews he does, and also the people around him, I think, shaped his politics.
So you're listening to KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, and we're speaking with Robin D.G. Kelly about his forthcoming book, Thelonious, A Life. And I actually got a little taste, a little tease of what the book is going to look like. I was looking on the net, and I found an article you wrote called The New Monastery, Thelonious Monk and the Jazz Avant-Garde. And in here, when you were talking about the police, I just want to read a quote that is actually what Monk actually said. In the United States, the police bother you more than they do anywhere else. The police heckle you. You don't have as much trouble anywhere else in the world except for the United States. The police just mess with you for doing nothing. They bully you and all that kind of stuff. They carry guns too, and they shoot people for nothing. So, I mean, just in terms of, that seems a little bit more outspoken than their
absolutely.
Kind of plan.
In fact, you remind me of something else I should mention, is that San Juan Hill not only was a place of amazing black talent, it was a place of amazing violence. It was called San Juan Hill for a reason, you know, because the violence between, first of all, the black community and the mostly immigrant white community who lived on the avenue, on Amsterdam Avenue, used to battle, but also the police used to come in there and literally wage war on the black community there. And so I have one incident when Monk was about 10 years old, maybe 11, where a shootout took place right in front of his apartment, you know, and an African-American man was killed as a result by police. So there's a lot of violence that went on. A lot of that violence came from the police in the neighborhood. And so I think that also shaped his outlook, you know, on state violence.
I have two questions, Rob, and one is that one of our producers wanted to say that we're sure you've seen the film Straight No Chaser.
Yes.
And what do you think about it? And I guess one question would be, is there a message difference or an approach difference between that film and your book? And then I have a second question.
There is, and in fact, Straight No Chaser is actually a recut version of a TV program that was aired in Europe in 1968. Actually, two shows, one called Monk in Europe and the other one simply called Monk. And I saw the original, and the way Straight No Chaser is cut is very, very different from the original, although both kind of capture a particular moment in Monk's life when he was, you know, suffering from mental illness. He was on tour, both in the United States and Europe. And he also, in some ways, was performing for the camera. There are some poignant moments that end up being cut out of Straight No Chaser that's in the original, which hopefully will be released one of these days. There is a significant difference. For one thing, that slice of Monk's life, to me, doesn't capture the whole. You know, it also, in some ways, I think, it tends to romanticize his mental illness. You know, people suffer as a result of his suffering. Whole communities, whole families suffer. And that's part of what I want to get at. You know, what happens after about 1960 when his health starts to go downhill. And it's not just his mental health, but his physical health. He suffers from prostate problems. He has trouble sitting for long periods of time. I mean, a lot of things are going on. To me, my story is about two things. It is about an artist and his family, you know, the relationship that he develops as a member of a family in a community and how that shapes his own development as an artist. But it's also about an artist's relationship to the world. You know, through Monk, we see what's happening in Japan in the 1960s. Through Monk, we see, you know, Black America in the 1950s and 60s. We see Black America from the 19th century on up to his death. We see the communities whose activities are really shaping his own compositions and his own thinking about music. So it's not just like the tragic genius story. It's a story about an artist who's as much a product of his community and vice versa.
Well, my other question was, you just casually mentioned on the first cut we did all the things you want, Milt Jackson. Did he go on to do the Modern Jazz Quartet?
Yes.
So one of the questions I always find fascinating is if you take a lead man like Thelonious, there are all these people that have played with him at one point or another, you know. Who were some of the key? Did he have certain people that were his key? You know, I know the Miles Davis group's much better. People who stayed with him for a long time, his main bass player, his main, you know, his main drummer, sax, trumpet, whatever. Could you maybe tell us something about the evolution of the different Thelonious Monk quartets, quintets, and stuff like that?
Sure. Up until, let's see, I would say well, there's two things that are important. One is that after about 1948, Monk ceases to be a sideman for anyone. There's a couple times when he makes albums with people like Clark Terry, and he makes albums with people like Jerry Mulligan, but essentially he's not really a sideman. He just happens to be on the date with them. But it's important to realize that he's always a leader. Like, once he establishes himself, he's a leader. By the time you get into, like, about 1958, that's when he starts to establish a really solid foundation in his quartet. Charlie Rouse, a saxophone player from Washington, D.C., becomes a permanent member of his group for 12 years. The longest relationship with Charlie Rouse, who's a tenor saxophone player who's wonderful, made a lot of records with him on Columbia Records. After that, there were a number of drummers who played with him pretty regularly. One is Frankie Dunlop, who's still living, still here in New York City. Another one is Ben Reilly, who made some outstanding recordings with him. And they pretty much dominated the 60s. Monk's own son, T.S. Monk, played with them in the last years of his life. But one thing I should also mention is that he did have a favorite saxophone player. You know, at least he mentioned this. He said, you know, he always wanted Sonny Rollins in his band.
Hmm.
And he loved Sonny Rollins. In fact, Sonny Rollins did play with him for a little while, but not as a permanent member. And to Monk's great disappointment, he, you know, went on to do his own thing. But that was the one person who thought, like, really mastered his music.
And what album, if we were looking for going back, what album is there, could you remember, that Sonny Rollins plays on?
Well, one of the great ones is Brilliant Corner.
Oh, really? Okay,
which good. Which is a perfect segue, because
I hope you have that in the studio.
We definitely do. Actually, before we get to that, I want to ask you one quick question just about saxophonists. When we got together and we were saying we were going to actually talk to you about Monk, you have... You know, Manuel, who's also a co-host, you have Maggie LaPique, who's our engineer, all saying, well, ask Robin this. So this one is coming from Manuel.
Okay.
He wanted to know, in terms of, there was a brief time, I think it was about 7 months, where John Coltrane actually worked with Thelonious Monk. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And so why was it so short, and what did the meaning of those two kind of giants, what did it do to change kind of the jazz world?
Yeah, it was a little longer than 7 months, but it was, which is, for someone like John Coltrane, who was going on his own, that it was amazing that he stayed that long, and he stayed that long for a reason. Coltrane loved Monk. Coltrane said, Thelonious Monk is the heart, is an architect of the highest order. I mean, those are Coltrane's words. And he felt like his relationship with Monk was an apprenticeship. And the way the story is, first of all, Monk knew Coltrane from, you know, really the early 50s. You know, they knew each other into the mid-50s. And Coltrane used to go over to Monk's house and practice. He'd get to this house like 7 o'clock in the morning and just wait. You know, wait until, you know, Monk was up, and he'd get up, and then he'd start practicing, and Nellie would make him breakfast. And so they had a very close relationship. Then, at the time, Coltrane was with Miles Davis. Miles Davis fired Monk. I'm sorry, Miles Davis fired Coltrane, sorry. Monk watched the whole thing. He watched the violence that Miles meted out to Coltrane at the time. Coltrane himself had a bad heroin addiction, and Monk said, look, you know, come join me. And that's when he joined him at the Fox Spot for a historic gig that lasted, you know, for all, you know, several months. And then Coltrane then went back to Miles, and then after that he went on his own to do his own thing with Monk's blessings. They did play again, though, in a concert that was never recorded in Detroit just before Coltrane died. I think it was in January of 1966, where they just happened to be on the same bill together. It was snowing, terrible storm, and George Ween told me the story about how they decided just to play together in this concert, and it was the most fun that Coltrane had had in a long time, playing with the old master, and they didn't play again after that, and then, of course, Coltrane died the year after.
Okay, so I think we're going to go to Brilliant Corners. Why don't you do a little introduction for it?
Yeah, Brilliant Corners was, more than anything else, Monk's coming out album. It won all kinds of critics' polls. It was considered the number one album in Japan. We're going to hear the title track, Brilliant Corners, which itself was such a complicated song that it took 25 takes, and what we're about to hear is actually several pieces of it spliced together because they never got a complete take. Sonny Rollins himself said it was the most difficult song he had to play, and if you listen to it, just for, you know, whether you like jazz or not, think of this song as a circle. You know, it's going around in circles and circles, and at one point it double times, and the circle gets faster, and it slows down again. And so you'll hear some great solos on this record.
So we're going to... Unfortunately, I can't play the whole thing because we want to talk to you some more. So we're going to play a little bit over 4 minutes of it, and we'll be right back with Robin Kelly. Thank you. We're back with Voices from the Front Lines. That was Thelonious Monk, Sonny Rollins, for Brilliant Corners. And we're on the line with Robin D.G. Kelly. Robin, tell us about it.
Yeah, that recording was made actually 5 days after Monk's birthday in 1956. And the saxophonist you heard, the first one, the tenor saxophone, that's Sonny Rollins there. And then you heard Monk solo. Also on that record, Oscar Pettiford is the bass player, and wow, he had so many fights with Monk over this one recording, which took 4 hours, by the way, to finally get through, that he never played with Monk again after that. And then, of course, the drummer is the great Max Roach. You know, so it's an all-star cast, you know. I mean, just great. And then the alto player on that is Ernie Henry, who many people have not heard of because he died very young. In fact, he died the year after this was made, aged 31. He was someone that Monk loved. He loved his sound. And in fact, in making this recording, Monk had his manager, Harry Columbia, drive him around Brooklyn in the pouring rain trying to find him, you know, just to make this record. And I think it took several hours. And they finally located him and got him into the studio. And the rest is history, you know. It's really an amazing record.
Especially getting all those people in
the
in a room together. It's like, so just trying to take it back to, there's a particular part in your article that talks about kind of Monk's relationship to the Black Liberation Movement. And I think that a lot of times there's two different sides are trying to claim them. The right side who's saying, like, you know, Monk is great because he keeps the politics and the music separate. And then you have him, on the other hand, doing benefits for Paul Robeson. You have him doing benefits for SNCC. So what do you think about the history of his involvement in the movement?
No, it's a really good point. I mean, the thing about that moment, in the moment you're referring to, really is around 1963-64, when, you know, 1964 in February, Monk is on the cover of Time magazine, you know, which is a huge, huge deal. It's the third jazz musician to have that honor. And, in fact, he was supposed to be on the cover in November of 63, but then the assassination of Kennedy knocked him off.
Who were the other two? Duke Ellington?
Yeah, well, Duke Ellington and Dave Brubeck.
Okay.
Was the other one. And it's very, very interesting, that moment, because here he's becoming more famous than ever. The National Review, you know, is singling him out as a kind of hero, because in 64 something else is happening in the music scene, and that is what's called the October Revolution in Jazz. And what is the October Revolution in Jazz? It was a concert organized by the jazz avant-garde, kind of declaring itself present. I mean, a lot of the great musicians, and Cecil Taylor and Archie Shepp and others, and many others, put together this thing. And Monk, because Monk wasn't really identified as part of the quote-unquote avant-garde, to the right, he was seen as someone who sort of plays traditional swing music and understands that music has to swing. And that had political implications, because they would connect his music with his interviews, you know, where in the interviews he'd say, well, I'm not interested in changing my name. I already got a funny name. I don't need to be a Muslim. Here's him in interviews saying that I'm not a politician, which is not the same as saying I'm not interested in struggle. He's simply saying this is not my job to be a spokesperson for the race. But that gets interpreted as being apolitical. In the French interview, by the way, a year later, he says he was read the quote back to him. He said, I never said such a thing. You know, that's ridiculous. In any case, they've got the right claiming him for his apoliticism. And meanwhile, you've got publications like The Liberator, you know, the publication of the Black Liberation Movement in Harlem, writing articles about just how revolutionary his music is and claiming him for the black nationalists. And meanwhile, Time magazine, which is like supposedly the middle of the road, but we know what that means, is also claiming him as a hero, you know, partly because they see his apolitical position as part of his childlike behavior. You know, in other words, he's not really a fully grown person. He's more of an idiot savant. And meanwhile, as you mentioned, he's playing benefits for SNCC, for CORE, and you know, he volunteering his time to support these movements.
And also, we were talking about earlier just the people in his actual band.
Yes.
And who they were.
Yeah, yeah, that's it's another interesting thing. In the 40s, when he was coming up, he hired a number of Muslims, people like Idris Suleiman, Sahib Shihab, all of whom were members of the Ahmadiyya movement, Art Blakey, you know, who went by Buhaina. There were a number of Muslims who were very politically active and engaged. Many of them came out of Dizzy Gillespie's band. And at one point, he had more Muslims in his band than except for Art Blakey. Art Blakey had a band that was primarily followers of Islam. You know, that's how the Messengers came about. You know, the Messengers, Art Blakey and the Messengers, it was initially a 17-piece band, 17 Messengers of Allah, is what he meant that to mean.
Well, one of the things I'm struck by in your interview and looking forward to your book, Thelonious of Life, what's the publisher going to be, Robin?
Oh, the Free Press.
Great, Free Press. Is, you know, the efforts to hold anything together, you know, any piece of reality together are so hard. I mean, here is a man with tremendous genius and then physical problems. I mean, if his back's hurting him, couldn't be one of the worst things to be a pianist with a bad back. Mental problems, been arrested 4 times, note, always for drugs, the famous criminalization of drugs, half the time in cars, just minding his own business.
Mm-hmm.
The egos of musicians, the efforts to take, you know, like, is, I mean, to think that Ornette Coleman and Archie Shepp are the left and somehow Thelonious Wright, Monk and... whatever is the right, you know, is Oscar Peterson the right? Horace Silver the right? I mean, you know, all the fights within the black community, the white system trying to portray you a different way. It's amazing any black person makes it, you know. I mean, it's like the whole world is like a maze set up to let alone deny a black collectivity, which
absolutely.
Is, you know, I mean, you may make it as a black person. But all the different pressures against black collectivity and nationhood is just reflected in this interview.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and he'd be the first one to recognize that because, you know, there's two things that you've really struck upon. And one is that it was very, very important for him to be connected to his family and to his community. That was so critical for his own mental health and spiritual health. And he always did that. I mean, this is a man who, interestingly enough, I have no evidence at all of any infidelities. He's only had 2 girlfriends in his life. You know, one is the wife, Nellie, and then Ruby Richardson, his first. He's always been committed to family and committed to community. But the second thing, which I think is just, to me equally important, is that he maintained a sense of humor. If there's anything that his music conveys consistently is humor. I mean, all those songs, I mean, all his little runs and little riffs and phrases are just, you know, little jokes, you know, and he understood that. He'd always elicit a laugh from people by the amazing things he's able to do on that piano.
So this is KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. We're speaking with Robin D.G. Kelly, who is the professor of anthropology, African-American Studies and Jazz Studies at Columbia University, author of Freedom Dreams, and author of the forthcoming book, Thelonious of Life. So we're going to have to say goodbye. I want to say thank you so much. But
thank you.
On the way out, our next guest, Socha Bavetta, who is from basically trying to attack the Louisiana juvenile justice system, intro onto her is Crisscross. So maybe you can tell us if you can... pull it up in the database. Tell us about that.
Oh yeah, Crisscross. Crisscross is one of the. I just real briefly, it was Gunter Schuller, who was a big fan of Monk's, called Crisscross like his genius song, and he did a whole variant on Thelonious Monk's music based on Crisscross. It's one of the songs that is really classic Monk composition, and I won't say much more than that. It speaks for itself.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Robin, and we'll be right back.
Okay. Thank you.